to another edition of the Health First Radio Show. On this week's show, Kathy Hart will be speaking with Chris Ferguson about mental health and gaming. And then in the last half hour, Dr. Leo Trasande, the author of Sicker, Fatter, Poorer. But before we get to that, here's this week's health news.
People who drink alcohol don't only put themselves at risk. They're also endangering family and friends. A new study finds the effect of secondhand alcohol harms are widespread, with nearly 1 in 5 Americans, 53 million people, reporting having been harmed by someone else's drinking during the past year. Those harms include threats or harassment, damaged property, vandalism, physical aggression, financial problems, relationship issues, and issues related to driving. Heavy drinkers should be aware of how they might be impacting the lives of people around them, said study co-author Catherine Carrico-Jaffe. She is a senior scientist with the Alcohol Research Group at the Public Health Institute in Emeryville, California. The study findings were published July 1st in the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration might soon revoke soy's long-standing claim to boost cardiovascular health, but now comes long-term research that appears to bolster the notion that soy does indeed do our heart good. Canadian researchers pored over the results of 46 separate trials. Their conclusion? These data strongly support the rationale behind the original FDA heart health claim for soy, said study lead author David Jenkins. He's a professor of nutritional sciences and medicine at the University of Toronto. Co-author John Stephen Piper, also professor of nutritional sciences at the university, stressed that the overall benefit of soy for heart health wasn't major, just an average 5% reduction in cholesterol levels. However, he said in a university news release, if you put that together with other plant-based foods in the portfolio, you get a much stronger effect. The findings were published June 27th in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Multiple sclerosis is a tough disease to manage and live with, but a new long-running Norwegian study suggests it might also raise cancer risk. Overall, the higher risk was small, just 12%. However, the risk of certain cancers, such as central nervous system cancers and urinary cancers, were about 50% higher in people with multiple sclerosis, and respiratory cancers were about two-thirds more likely to occur in people with MS, the study found. The study didn't only raise concerns for people with MS, however. 7 decades of research also suggested that the siblings of people with MS who didn't have the disease themselves had about an 80% increased risk of blood cancers, such as leukemia, compared to their MS-affected siblings and people in the general population without MS. The study was presented recently at the European Academy of Neurology Congress in Oslo, Norway. Infants and young children with vitamin D deficiency may have a heightened risk for elevated blood pressure later in childhood and in their teens, a new study finds. Researchers followed 775 children in Boston from birth to age 18. Most were from low-income families in urban neighborhoods. Compared to children born with normal vitamin D levels, those born with low levels, less than 11 nanograms per millimeter in cord blood, had a 60% higher risk of elevated systolic blood pressure between ages 6 and 18. High systolic pressure increases heart disease risk even when diastolic pressure is controlled, the researchers noted. The study was published July 1st in the journal Hypertension.
Produced at CFIS-FM in Prince George, Health First is available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
So we'd like to welcome Dr. Ferguson to the show today. We are going to be talking about video games and what is happening to people's brains and all the research that's been done. So welcome, Dr. Ferguson. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Sure, yes, and thank you for having me on today. I'm a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at Stetson University, which is down in Florida. And for about 15 years now, I've primarily been doing research on various aspects of video games and other media and the way that media may or may not have an influence on our behavior. And also kind of interested in the way that sort of society responds to new media and new technology and kind of the narratives that form about whether technology is good or bad or whatever else may be going on. But more recently, I've been kind of involved in this sort of discussion about whether gaming addiction or pathological gaming exists as kind of a standalone mental health disorder, or whether it is better conceptualized as being kind of a symptom of other issues like depression or anxiety. And of course, that's a big issue that's going on right now, because the World Health Organization is moving forward with a gaming disorder diagnosis, and that's created a fair amount of controversy.
Okay, and if they've come through where it's going to actually be a diagnosis, what kind of things could we expect as prognosis, and what would we use for healing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is important to point out that, you know, the World Health Organization, you know, movement or decision on this issue has been controversial, and there has been pushback by other organizations, you know, such as the media divisions of the American Psychological Association, the Psychological Society of Ireland, which are opposed to making this a diagnosis. So there is still a lot of back and forth about whether this should or should not be a diagnosis or not. I mean, I think that, you know, there are possibly both good and bads that may come, you know, from some of this. So I think what happens with a lot of individuals, and it's really important to point out that when we talk about, like, prevalence rates for things like gaming disorder, we're really talking about 1% or less of people who play video games. So it's not like an epidemic. You know, it's not like there's a massive number of people that are showing these kinds of issues. But, you know, whether it's a real disorder or not, the behaviors where a person is spending, you know, inordinate amounts of time gaming and they're not engaging with other activities like work or school or exercise, you know, whether it's a real diagnosis or not, a real disorder or not, it still might be a red flag that there may be some individuals that are struggling with things like depression or anxiety and maybe turning to games to kind of improve their mood. You know, in terms of, you know, prognosis, I mean, I think this is where some of the debate is going to happen over the next few years, is we don't really have an established treatment that's been scientifically verified, you know, for this thing. So there's really a debate that's now happening about whether, you know, this should be considered a red flag and people should be treated for their depression or their anxiety and whatever else they may be experiencing, or do people need to be specifically treated for their gaming with the goal of reducing their gaming, and that's kind of it, you know, and that's really the main goal of treatment. So I think over the next few years we'll see a lot of that shake out and hopefully have some good research to indicate what the best direction is.
So, Chris, do you think that these games are actually set up to create addiction? I mean, you have to go to so many levels and wrap the game. They're pretty hard to leave.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about that. I would say that there probably are a lot of things out there that are fun and tend to grab people. And games are one of those things, but not by any means unique in that respect. So we actually do see research on other disorders such as, like, exercise addiction and work addiction and shopping addiction. There actually are literally papers on dance addiction. So there are other sorts of activities that people, you know, also overdo. And there's not really good evidence to suggest that games, or at least most video games, are any more addictive than a lot of other activities are. And that was probably one mistake that the World Health Organization made, was focusing in on video games specifically rather than having sort of a, you know, behavioral regulation disorder that could have fit a lot of different things. You know, so for the most part, I would say probably not. And the kind of rationalizations people make about why games are addictive could probably be applied to a lot of different things. I sometimes kind of half facetiously talk about, like, cat addiction as kind of like an example. You kind of talk about, like, games having this, like, variable reinforcement schedule, which means that you kind of have to, it's kind of like slot machines, you know, sometimes they reward you, sometimes they don't. But cats are kind of like that. You know, sometimes they love you, sometimes they don't. You know, you hear a lot about, like, dopamine, the idea that, like, dopamine gets released in the brain. But that's actually pretty normal. So, like, stroking a cat releases dopamine in the brain. You know, so these are all very normal sorts of things. And they're present in video games, but they're present in a lot of other things, you know, as well. Now, where there's a bit more attention more recently on games is there may be certain mechanisms in some games that people worry about a bit more. So one is something that's called a loot box. So if listeners are not familiar with that, that's basically a mechanism in the game where the players can spend a little bit of money in order to get a reward, but they don't know what the reward is. So they're trying to get a really good reward, but they may get a junky reward, you know, and they don't know. They pay before they know what they're going to get. So to a lot of people, that looks a little bit closer to gambling, and that makes people a little bit more worried about that. And I'll say I'm not a fan of loot boxes myself. What the evidence we have on those right now suggests is that people who tend to have pre-existing problems with gambling disorder tend to spend more on loot boxes than people who don't have gambling problems. But there's not really evidence yet that the loot boxes are causing, you know, the gambling addiction or any kind of other issues. So, and we're really talking about a difference about $40 to $50 a month. So it's not like really massive amounts of money either necessarily. But that's one mechanism that is kind of unique to games. Some games. Some games have them, many games don't, that people are a little bit more worried about right now.
And what would it look like if we were looking at our anyone in our family or friends or that? How would you identify if you're kind of tipping the edge where this isn't just fun anymore, that it's overtaking your life?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing that we do now know is that time spent on games is not a good indication of problems. So you really do have people that spend hours and hours and hours playing video games. They're having a great time. They're socializing with people online. And they're not having any problems. You know, they are studying as much as they need to or doing their work like they need to. They're exercising. You know, their life is fine. What we tend to look for is what we call interference. So are the games, stopping people from doing other things that they need to do? You know, are they, not studying if they're younger? You know, are they late for work all the time if they're a little bit older? You know, are they not exercising anymore like they used to? Are they not getting adequate sleep? You know, are they not socializing? In many situations, you may hear people express that, I really wish I would play less video games, but I have difficulty, cutting back like I would like to. So those tend to be the kind of things to look for. Is it really kind of getting in the way of a lot of other activities that the person needs to do or wants to do, or are they expressing distress about the amount of games that they're playing? Where a lot of, particularly parents and grandparents tend to make mistakes is that they see their kids playing a lot, particularly during the summer, so kids have a lot of time now. So maybe the summer, and they see their kids playing games for hours and hours and hours a day, and they really would rather than do something else. And that may be fair enough, but that's not necessarily a gaming disorder. So as long as the gaming is not interfering with important stuff that the kid needs to do, simply thinking, I wish my kid were outside looking at trees, that may be a fair parenting argument, but it isn't a sign of a gaming disorder. So that's kind of the important distinction for people to make.
Mm-hmm. And does this affect, I'm sure there are some benefits to actually playing and having that fast reaction time and that, but does it cause any problems with circadian rhythms and how much blue light is making a change for us, and what kind of changes are blue lights making?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there really are kind of two issues, at play. It's one, particularly for teenagers, there's a lot of research now to suggest that, like, the school schedule is just not set up well for teenagers. So teenagers tend to naturally want to wake up later in the morning and stay awake later into the evening. But unfortunately, in most districts, schools tend to start at 7:30 a.m. or something pretty absurd. So there's already kind of a mismatch between sort of like life schedule and teenagers' normal circadian rhythms. Now, there is some data that suggests that screens or screen media, or just lights in general to some extent, can interfere with sort of normal sleep-wake cycles. Basically, the brain's being stimulated with a little bit too much light, and it thinks it's still kind of daylight. And that can cause problems with insomnia or reduced sleep. And, in some situations, having difficulty with sleep, not getting enough sleep, can lead to further problems, obviously, with concentration, but also even with depression or anxiety or things like that. So generally, the recommendation is to have an established time where all the screens are turned off, all the lights are turned off, and that can be whatever works for a particular individual, a particular family, but, not to try to put yourself to sleep by watching television, playing video games, working with your cell phone or so on and so forth, because that can interrupt sleep schedules.
Mm-hmm. And there's a large experimental time when you're a teenager or a 20-ager and you're just finding everything exciting in life. And so this could be kind of almost akin to trying a drink or a drug, but not ever being addicted, but just challenging what's out there to give you that rush.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the tricks of technology in general, particularly if it's so available in modern society, is really this I think we kind of have to start with understanding that a lot of like real life is just dull, you know, and that's just kind of like the starting point. Like, you know, a lot of kids find school to be dull. A lot of kids find homework to be dull. And that's been true for as long as there's been school and homework. You know, and it's sort of natural to want to gravitate towards things that are more exciting, more novel, more stimulating. And, you know, technology can provide that. And, you know, that's a great thing. You know, technology has improved life in many ways, and video games and screens and all the stuff have improved life in many ways. And it's just a matter of balancing it and having proper boundaries. You know, so where do we need to cut off our access to screens so that we can get adequate sleep, so that we can force ourselves to engage with some of the more boring things that we have to do, like schoolwork or just work. Everything is probably positive in moderation. You know, when people overdo things, that can be a sign that something in their social system or their mental health is kind of breaking down. You know, it still can be a red flag that something else has gone out of balance and that the person may need help, or if it's the individual, that they may need to recognize that they need a little bit of help.
Okay, we're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking about how gaming affects the brain.